Okay, then this is, I'm just really happy and excited to welcome Harlan, and so let's go.
Is this thing on? Good, okay, hi, good morning, I'm Harlan. I am a recovered compulsive overeater, and I am from Scottsdale, Arizona. As you're going to hear this morning, I'm originally born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. There's Lake Michigan straight right here in these veins, and that is definitely a part of me that I am from Chicago. I came to this disease instantly, and I came to this disease very naturally. I have suffered from this illness from the very moment that I was born. I am not one of these people that all of a sudden woke up one day and said, gosh, I'm having some trouble with food, I'm in my 30s or 40s. Well, no, that is not my story. I have very vivid memories of people screaming and yelling at my mother and father when I was pre-kindergarten about how fat I was getting and how much I was eating. I have very vivid memories of that, and I have very vivid memories of then people starting to, when I was 5 and 6 years old, and them screaming directly at me and admonishing me in the strongest possible terms that fat boys don't get girls. I found that out. Fat boys don't get good jobs, I found that out. And if I could tell you anything about my childhood relative to this illness, and that is I woke up every morning of my life with an existential sense of being wrong, of being different, and of being on the outside looking in. Because when you are fat, you are automatically wrong. My mother was mentally ill. That's not why I'm a compulsive overeater. My mother had 3 distinct personalities. My mother could be a 3-year-old 1 minute. My mother could be a screaming, raving lunatic the next minute. And then my mother could be a totally together, normal sounding human being the next minute, but you never knew what you were gonna get, when you were gonna get it, or how long it was going to last. And I spent a lot of my effort as a child trying to corral her into that normal personality. And I was as cold and cruel to her as I could have possibly been, because I wanted to punish her for embarrassing me and making my life hell. My dad was 54 years old when I was born. My dad was 60 by the time I was in kindergarten. My dad was from Russia. Pre-World War II, not Holocaust, but pre-World War II, he came to this country in 1914 amongst the vicious, most murderous anti-Semitism that the world has ever seen. He came from an extended family of about 40 people. He was the sole survivor on a night when they were obliterated off the face of the earth. For reasons which no one will live long enough to understand. The hatred against Jews at that time in Russia was unbelievable. And these people were murdered in front of them, in front of him. He remembered the screaming and the yelling. He remembered the murder and the mayhem all of his life. And he would tell me every day of my life, they're going to kill us, it's just a matter of when. They're going to kill us. They're going to kill us for sure. They hate us and they're going to kill us. They hate us and they're going to kill us. And I'm growing up in this. My mother and father hated one another. And my memories are very vivid of this. When I was 3 and 4 years old, I was my mother's husband and I was my father's wife. Not in a sexual sense, I wasn't having sex with them, but they would speak to me when I was 3, 4 years old and say, I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you. He doesn't make a living. He's not a good businessman. He's this, he's that. And then my father would come home and he would say, I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you. And all I wanted to know was Yogi Bear going to get away with the picnic basket? Because Boo Boo and him were getting picnic baskets, but Ranger Smith was coming around the corner. Or Huckleberry Hound was in some sort of trouble, and that's what I wanted. You know, I wanted to make sure that Huckleberry Hound could get away with, you know, whatever he was trying to get away with. And I'm growing up in this, and there was only one time, they fought constantly, there was only one time when there was all peace on the horizon, when the guns of Navarone were quiet, and that was when
there was massive amounts of food on that table, and I mean massive amounts of food on that table. And I became a compulsive overeater not because of them. If they were Laura and Rob Petrie, who I wanted for parents desperately, if they were Rob and Laura Petrie, I still would have been a compulsive overeater. And what we're going to be talking about this morning are some of the reasons why we are, or the reasons why we are compulsive overeater, if we are. And we're also going to talk this morning or today about the vast cavern of difference between what a lot of people in OA are in, which is dieting with group support, and real recovery therefrom. And so as I get older, my feelings of being different, of course, a lot of that is ego. That's just not compulsive overeating. Ego makes you different and separates you from the group. But I started getting fatter and fatter, and my problems from this illness started mounting up on me. And when I was about 9 years old, I have very vivid memories of going to a doctor, Dr. Jacobson, on Devon and Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, and he gave me amphetamines. He gave me diet pills so I could lose weight. I remember my mother screaming at him in Yiddish, and him screaming back in Yiddish, and the windup was I was on massive doses as a 9-year-old of diet pills. And I remember the temples in my head would just go ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And you sleep about 20 minutes a month. And you can't, but you don't eat. You definitely do. Oh, food is the last thing on your mind. I have memories, and I get accused of this now, I have memories of saying the same thing like 4 million times. I was like motor mouth. I couldn't stop myself from talking and saying the same thing again and again. I couldn't hear anything that anybody was really saying to me. My head was just so garbled up with this amphetamine. And when the teachers would be talking in school, it sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, wah, 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 wah. I didn't know what the hell was going on, but I wasn't eating and I was losing weight and everything seemed okay. But when you're on those pills, and I don't know how many of you were, when you're on those pills, those diet pills, and you crash, and that's really the only word I can use, it's like just going off on a roller coaster, just coming down a roller coaster and hitting bottom, then you want to eat. You eat Illinois and most of Wisconsin. So then when I got to be about 10 years old, some of the information on the dangers of these diet pills started coming out. And so they switched me from a pink pill to a blue pill. If you get spit on, that's part of the problem of sitting in the front row. But they switched me from a pink pill to a blue pill. Same effect, same exact thing. But when the pills would wear off, I would eat Illinois and most of Wisconsin. As a child, not even as a teenager, I did lose weight with AIDS. Remember those AIDS candies if you're my age? And when I got into high school, things really started to accelerate in terms of feeling like I wanted to be like the other kids. I wanted God to give me the gift of a thin body, but yet I wanted to eat everything I wanted to eat. And when I was a kid, I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 54. You can do the math. I'm 62. But I went in the 60s, everything was skin tight and straight as an arrow. The Levi's and the Trimsters were just straight as an arrow, and the Madras shirts and the whole thing was just, you know, crazy. And I wanted to look like the other kids. If you weren't from the 60s and you have this idea that everybody wanted to do their own thing, that's horse hockey. We all wanted to look the same. We all wanted to fit in. We wanted to be the same. And I had to wear clothes that went out of style like before World War II, but, you know, in the Great Depression. My dad would bring me into the old neighborhood in Albany Park in Chicago, and we would have to, if it fit me, and I could wear it, and it wasn't skin tight, you know, it wasn't bursting,
We bought it. So I walked around with like four or five pairs of pants that I owned, but they were always exactly the same style, same color. So it looked like I was wearing the same pair of pants for like years. But I wanted to look like them desperately, and I wanted to be them. And of course, you get into your puberty, and if you get spit on, that's part of the problem of being in the first row. I get into that, and you know, I had crushes on these girls, but of course, now I was the fattest kid in the school, and I was emasculated by this disease physically and emotionally at a very, very early age. And as I got into high school, things started getting way beyond me. I didn't look like the other boys. I couldn't do the things the other boys did. But especially when the girls would flip their hair and giggle, that was never, and if they wanted to talk to me at all, they wanted to know, does your friend like me? Does your friend think about me? How the hell do I know? Go ask him. But anyway, so that was hurtful. And then when I got into high school, I did TOPS, Take Off Pound Sensibly. I did that. I did Weight Watchers. I was a Weight Watchers king. I went down to the Pitt Congress Hotel, and they strutted me in the teenage thing. I was like Miss Illinois, and I'm up there. And on the way home, I was eating tacos, you know, from whatever, and I was eating God knows what on the way home. So I was never really in any type of recovery whatsoever. I was dieting with group support, and I was just hanging on by a thread, stark, raving, abstinent. And that's what you see a lot of in OA today, is stark, raving, abstinence. You don't see that real release, and we're going to be talking about that today. As I started to get into my 20s, some other things were happening. My mother was not only mentally ill, my mother was physically ill as well. My mother was a compulsive overeater. And when I was out of high school, I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. When I got into college, I was about 500 pounds. And my mother and father were about 275 apiece, so that's 550, and I was about 500 and change. So we were about 1,050, 1,100 pounds between three adults. Well, I mean, this was massive craziness. I mean, this was craziness at a tremendous level. As I started gaining weight like that in leaps and bounds, accentuated by the fact that now I've got some money, now I've got a car, now I'm older, I can get my hands on more food than I could when I was five, plus the progressive nature of the illness, and as I got older, the illness became worse and worse and worse, things really started spinning away from me very, very much. My friends were out in colleges like Arizona State and University of Southern California and, you know, whatever, and they were going to these campus schools, and I had to stay home because my mother and father were getting sicker and sicker and sicker, physically, not just mentally, but physically. And my mother died when I was 22 years old. She had her leg amputated from diabetes. Not long before she died, that was traumatic, and my mother was on dialysis. Now, if you've lived in Chicago, you know that dialysis, you've got to get your butt to that hospital. I don't care if it's a snowstorm, I don't care if the snow is up to your eyeballs, you got to get there. So there's no negotiating. You have to get to that dialysis center at Illinois Masonic Hospital, and you better get there on time, or you're going to be sitting there for a long time. So that was a pain in the tuchus. So that was terrible. And then when I was 22 years old, my mother passed away. And when I was 24 years old, my father had cancer. My father was a heavy smoker. I mean, one after the other, after the other. He would often light one with the other. He'd light the new one with the old one and keep smoking. And you couldn't really tell him anything. His ability to be told what to do had been pretty used up by this time in his life. And he was very, very scared of the world. He was very frightened and very angry and very, very angry at God. And that's going to rear its ugly head as I start getting into this program, which is a spiritual program. And I have vivid memories of Dad when there'd be a Jewish holiday. And I lived in a neighborhood that was like 100% Jewish.
And when people would be walking to synagogue on, you know, Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah or High Holy Days, they'd be walking to synagogue. He'd be walking too, but he'd be walking like, poof. I didn't really spit on the floor, but poof. Because he had some questions for God, like, where were you? And why did you let him kill my nephew who was 6 months old? And why did you let him kill my niece who was 3 years old? And why did you let him kill my other nephew who was 6 years old? And why did you let him kill my sisters and my mother and my father and my uncles and my aunts and my grandparents and my cousins? Why did you allow this to happen? And for what reason? But beyond why they were killed, he had the question of, why did you let me live in this toilet of a world? Why did you let me live? Why was I the one to live? Why me? Why me? And then at other times, he would grab my face as a child. He would grab my face and he would say to me, don't ever forget that you're an American. And being an American is the greatest thing you can possibly be. There's no greater thing, and that's why I made it. He said, I made it out of that hell so you could be an American. That's what he told me every day of my life. They're going to kill us. They hate us. They're going to kill us. And you're wonderful. It's wonderful for you to be an American. So I'm trying to put this together and make some kind of sense out of it. And I'm not sure that there is any kind of sense. But this was my inculcation into a relationship with God. And then I go to Hebrew school and there's this punishing, you know, get you kind of guy. And so now that's kind of going to rear its ugly head too. I got sidetracked there. I wasn't meaning to say it. But anyway, that's okay. You never know. There's three retreats you do, or three big book studies I do. The one I plan, the one I do, and then the one I beat myself up for on the way home that I should have. I've been doing this a long time, so I know what to expect. That I'll be on that airplane tomorrow going, why did it turn? Okay, so the last conversation I had with my mother when she was dying and I was 22 years old, the last conversation I had with her was a conversation of, she'd say to me, Harlan, I saw such wonderful things in you. I saw such wonderful promise in you. Please find a way not to eat so much. She'd say, you think that you can go on this way forever? She said, you can't. Please find a way not to eat so much. And the last conversation I had with my father, the last lucid conversation I had with him, this was the night he died. He was green from cancer. I mean, he had it from head to foot. And he said to me, you're really alone now. He said, you're really alone now. He says, I'm sorry. And he said to me in Yiddish, he said, my zun, which means my son, which means that the eating, essen is eating normally, fressen is gluttonous eating. And he'd say that the fressen was an unglück, a curse into your life. And he said, I thought you could be the president of the United States, but when I saw the food coming into your life, it was a merdol chazak. A merdol chazak means a murderous killer thing. He said, I saw the food take you away from us. And this is what he told me. And then several hours later, he passed away. And the last thing he said to me in his lucid moment was, find a way not to eat so much. You're a slave to food. You're a slave to the food. Now, I do not know what your belief is. You could be an atheist, and that's okay. You're welcome here. You could be an agnostic. That's okay. You're welcome here if you are. That's okay. Or you could be a believer, that's okay too. Here is what I believe. I believe that my father held great stead with God Almighty. And I know that he is in heaven because he certainly lived hell on earth. I wouldn't wish his existence on anyone. I wouldn't wish that existence on my worst enemy. But not long after he died in November of 1978, on February 2nd, 1979, just weeks after he passed away, two friends pushed their way past the filth of my apartment, past the pizza boxes, past the M&Ms, past the O. Henry bar wrappers, past the containers of Hostess cupcakes, And I'd have my threesome today, Saturday. I'd have a threesome on Saturday night. Me, Little Debbie, and Sarah Lee. We'd have a beautiful threesome. Every once in a while, we'd make it into an orgy. We'd invite Ben and Jerry. They pushed their way past the filth. And I was 500-600 pounds at that time in 1979. I had been emasculated by this illness. I couldn't go to the movies because I couldn't fit in the seats. I wasn't making a living. The physical pain of being a compulsive overeater to that level was unbelievable. The contact dermatitis was so horrible. The contact dermatitis is when the skin rubs together and it causes these angry, weeping sores within me. I wasn't wearing underwear. I had towels shoved between layers of flab. I would wear towels, and the filth, the rolls in my neck, the filth would build up in there. So when it was a hot summer day, the dirt would come out of the folds in my neck. I had a couple of shirts with all the armpits were worn off, and I had cigarette burns and food stains in front of every shirt that I owned. I had no money. My car had been repossessed twice. I was writing bad checks to anyone stupid enough to take them. I was robbing Peter to rob Paul. I had my car repossessed twice. I drove when I drove without auto insurance because I wasn't going to buy auto insurance when I could buy tacos and hamburgers. My food habit at that time in the 1970s, not my heroin habit, not my cocaine habit, not my hooker habit, my food habit was about $100 to $150 a day, every day, no matter what. I would get up and start eating, and I would eat until I passed out at night. It would be one restaurant to the other, to one convenience store, to the other, to the other, to the other, and then eventually I would pass out. I couldn't wipe myself after going to the bathroom without a wall to lean against. The fat was so unbelievable in my life that I couldn't walk from here to the parking lot, and that's how I would walk around. And I would be sweating constantly. You know, I've lived, I told you I'm born and raised in Chicago. It'd be 30 degrees below zero. I wouldn't need a coat. Everybody would laugh. How come he doesn't? They'd say, where's your coat? And my other friends would say, what coat? He doesn't have a coat. Because I didn't need a coat because I was always sweating. I was always hot. I was always sweating. Now, I'm like a wimp. When I was a man in Chicago. I could take the weather. Now in Arizona, when it's in the 50s, I'm going, But your blood, you know, when I live in the hottest part of the country, you get used to the hot weather now, and that doesn't bother me so much. Bothers my German Shepherd, but doesn't bother me that much. But now when it's like in the 50s back home, I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? So anyway, I come into Overeaters Anonymous, stinking to high hell, filthy, dirty, writing bad checks, liar, manipulator. I had become everything I hated and detested in a human being. And here I am in Overeaters Anonymous, and I'm sitting there in a room on February the 2nd, 1979, at the Orchard Mental Health Center. God likes to laugh too. At the Orchard Mental Health Center in Skokie, Illinois. And I'm looking out at a room of people that look very much like what I see here tonight. Now, I'm 24 years old at that time, and there wasn't a person other than me in that room that was under 50. And I'm 20, 30 years younger than any of them, and they've got Lincoln Continentals and Cadillacs and high-end Buick Electra 225s and Toronados and in the parking lot, and I'm thinking, what are you doing here? I was talking about that yesterday. I don't remember. I think it was at dinner. Yeah, head of it. So I'm thinking, I know why I'm here, because I'm sitting on like four chairs, two for my ass, and you know I have to hang the arms so the fat can go down there, and I can't put my arms down because I got the fat around here, and I'm emasculated. Anyway, I can't figure out for the life of me what the hell you're doing here. What are you doing here? If I looked like you, I wouldn't be here. I sure wouldn't come here. And I came in for a couple of years. I went to a big book thing with Bill Bluestein from California, met him.
And very little took place except dieting with group support. And the OA that I walked into in 1979, really that's what we did, is we huddled together and we dieted with group support. There was no recovery really going on in those rooms at that time. We had the big book, we studied the big book to the best of our ability, but we were very distracted, very distracted. This person over here would come up with something, so we'd run over, much like early AA, we'd run over here, and then if they ate, we'd, oh, what do you got over here? Well, we'd run over here. And that's basically what I walked into, and I graduated. And I had a beautiful graduation ceremony. Some of you have had the same graduation ceremony. And they always say the same thing. Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? That's what they say about every graduation ceremony that I've been to. And that was my story. That was my story. So the bottom line is I left. You know, I didn't need this anymore. I was 400 or 500 pounds. I was cool. So the bottom line is that I had to come back. And I had to get beat down more, beat down more, beat down more, beat down more. And I came back in the 80s, and I went out again, and I came back at about 700 pounds plus. Hey girls, where are you going? You know, and I can't even walk at this time hardly, and I can't hardly move, and I can't. I'm pissing in my pants, I'm incontinent, and I'm crapping in my pants, and I smell like a trip to the zoo, and I'm filthy dirty, and I haven't brushed my teeth in years, and I haven't brushed my hair in years, and I want to die, and every day that I woke up was a curse, and I hated God for making me wake up, and I just wanted to be dead. There were times in high school I just wanted to be dead. There were times in grammar school I just wanted to be dead. There were times in college I just wanted to be dead. And I just wanted to be dead. I didn't want to live in this world anymore. And I came back into Overeaters Anonymous, and this time I guess I had been punished enough, because I came back and I started hearing things and seeing things that I just never heard or saw before. Like step zero, it's not officially step zero, but it's on page 58 of the big book. It says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take some steps. It's on page 58. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Well, what is it we have in Overeaters Anonymous? And I had a sponsor at that time that asked me a very pertinent question. It was at the Lincoln Park Alano Club in Chicago, and he asked me a very pertinent question of, why are you here? And I said, well, I want to go to a meeting. He said, not good enough. I said, well, I don't want to eat compulsively. He said, not good enough. He said, why are you here? And he would poke me in the chest with his big finger. And he'd say to me, are you out of ideas yet, kid? Because I was in my 20s, you know, and all the rest of them were in their 50s and 60s. And he'd say, are you out of ideas yet, kid? And then I'd say, oh, yeah, I guess. I was lying through my teeth. I tried I'm going to be abstinent 6 days a week, but on Sunday I'm going to eat everything I want to eat plan, and that failed. I'm going to be abstinent unless somebody has something that's kosher and vegan and gluten-free plan, and that, you know, that failed, that flopped. But anyway, on that particular February looms large in my recovery, he says, what are you doing here? And I couldn't come up with the right answer, and he gave me a beautiful answer. He said, there are people in that meeting that are not eating compulsively, and some of them, not all of them, are doing so happily. Because of a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps, they are not fighting food. They have been emancipated from their desire to eat it. And that's what I wanted. And then he said to me something else, a few things. Some of them were repeatable in mixed company, some were not. But then I noticed something else in the big book, and this was something that got my attention, because I always had this contentious kind of, oh, get you, you think you're going to get me, but you're not,
kind of relationship with God, and it's on page 45. It's the thesis line of the whole big book. It's on page 45, where it very simply says the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Doesn't say problems. A power greater than yourself. Notice it doesn't say anything about God. Again, if you are an atheist, welcome. If you are an agnostic, welcome. If you are a believer, welcome. Because all that's required is the willingness. You don't even have to believe. Is the willingness, and we're going to go over that in Bill's story, if I shut up. But we're going to go over that in Bill's story. Is the willingness to believe in a power greater than yourself. That's all that's required, is a willingness to believe in a power greater than yourself. And then he showed me something else, this man, and I found this to be very, very true. It's in the foreword to the second edition. It's on page XX, which is a size that I used to only dream about getting into. XX. And all the clothes I'm wearing today come from a regular store. Not a big and tall, not a big. All of them, right? Yeah, okay. Everything comes from a regular store. Okay. 100 people came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and 50% of them got sober at once. Of the remaining 50, 25 got sober. And of the remaining 25, they showed improvement. That's on page XX of the big book in the foreword to the second edition. That means 75% recovery. Now, I have done big book studies like this and retreats where it's Friday night, Saturday, Sunday. If you ever want me to come back and do one of those, I'd love to do that. But I have done these in 38 of the 50 states so far in my travels. And I have never seen 75% recovery. I have never seen 50% recovery. I have never seen 5% recovery. We are recovering in Overeaters Anonymous at a rate of about 1 to 1.5%, 2% tops. We are shrinking at an enormous rate in Overeaters Anonymous. We're losing about 1,100 meetings a month. And at the convention that I did, I spoke at this convention in New Orleans, Louisiana in the 80s, we had 150,000 members. And Boston, how many of you were in Boston at the World Convention? Boston? Not a person? Not a one of you? Okay. How many of you are in Vision for You? Meetings, phone, telephone? Oh. Okay, good. All right. Anyway, they announced that we're at 54,000 members. We've shrunk 100,000 members. I'm not here to preach to you, but I'm going to tell you my opinion. You're free to ignore it. This is my opinion. This is not verifiable in the big book. This is my opinion. That until we put big book back into the meetings, we're going to continue to go south. We need to put recovery back in the meetings. And if we put recovery back in the meetings, we will see these numbers jump up. We will see these numbers jump up. We will never have unity in Overeaters Anonymous. I don't care that this is being taped. I said this in Boston at the World Convention. We will never have unity in OA, in my opinion, until we put recovery back at the forefront of the meetings. We have too many people dieting with group support, and we have too many people that think this is a 9-tool program rather than a 12-step program. And until we get those numbers turned around, we are going to continue to dwindle and dwindle and dwindle. But that instruction in the foreword to the second edition tells me that as long as I stick to the pure message of this book, as long as I stick, I grab this one because it's big. As long as I stick to the pure, this is for me, this is not for you. You're free to ignore it. As long as I stick to this message, I will never want to eat again like that. The thought just will not cross my mind. And so this is the message that we have. I've had 18 years of beautiful recovery. I've lost a little over 500 pounds. And I have done so happily. I'm not swinging from the chandelier, stark raving abstinence.
I'm not swinging from the chandeliers, just trying to hold on for 10 more minutes and thinking it's 25 to 10, 10 o'clock, then we have 2 more hours, then we're going to go to lunch. Oh my God, where are we going to go to lunch? Am I going to get enough food? Am I get enough time to eat the food? And then of course, am I going to be able to go to the, I can't do that anymore. I'm too old for that stuff. I can't do it. I'd rather jump out the window now. Thank God we're on a low floor. But seriously, kill me now. I can't do it. I can't fight the world. I can't fight every issue of the world. I can't fight the food and fight every, I can't do it. And I'm not going to, and I don't have to. I don't have to. Vote for whoever you want. Leave my Facebook page alone. Do what you want. Go where you want. Do. I don't care. Whatever this guy or this woman, and I don't care. I'm just going to work my program. Now, let's take a look at what this is, and let's start unlocking some of the things. And we're going to talk now about step one. You know, for thousands of years, people have wondered about what is gluttony? What is alcoholism? What is addiction? Solomon, in the Book of Solomon, thousands of years ago, he wrote in the Book of Solomon, appropriately, he wrote that he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In the 1600s, around 1640 in England, there was a guy who also celebrated the same holidays as me, and his name was Dr. Trotter. And Dr. Trotter believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a man who signed the Declaration, and he became the nation's first Surgeon General, appointed by George Washington. In 1790, Dr. Benjamin Rush, and if you ever go to Chicago, how many of you have been to Chicago, Illinois? Oh, good, okay. If you've been there, you may have gone to a place called Rush Street, so named for him. Or you went to a hospital or passed it named Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's, so named for him. In 1790, he published a paper in which he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it and he had no cure for it. In New York, and there have been various attempts at combating alcoholism without knowing what it was. In the 1880s, there was a minister named, there was a minister in Pennsylvania, and he wanted to combat alcoholism, and he believed that alcoholism stemmed from a deficiency of B12 vitamin. And he developed a cracker, a wafer, that was jam-packed with B12 vitamins because he believed that alcoholism and masturbation could be cured if people took enough B12. And his name was Dr. Graham, and he developed his cracker as a way of combating alcoholism and masturbation. And the Graham crackers that we serve our kids today, or grandchildren as the case may be, don't have much to do with that. But that was where they originally came from, and that's why they're named that, because Dr. Graham was trying to combat alcoholism.
Wow.
In New York City, around the time of 1929, there was a guy who was a neurologist. He was not concerned with alcoholism. He didn't particularly consider anything there. And his name was Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. And on Black Tuesday, October 29th, 1929, when the stock market crashed and the Great Depression was on, he lost everything he had because he was over-invested in the market. And he lost everything he had. and his very dear friend, Charles Towns, gave him a job at the Towns Hospital in New York City on Central Park West, and he gave him a job for $35 a week at the Towns Hospital, and he became the medical director of this hospital. And between 1929, November of 29, and 1933 and 1934, when Bill Wilson is going to be hospitalized, he is going to witness thousands of alcoholics and thousands of non-alcoholics go through their door. And he would medically tend to their needs. These people would come in. Mostly they were men, but not all. Mostly they were men. And these men would come in, and they would feed them, and load them up with B12, and load them up with all kinds of other things that they were deficient in, and they would get these guys back on their feet, and they would release these guys back into their lives. Now, some of these men, not all of them, but some of these men were able to stay out of the hospital and never return. They learned their lesson, they were scared sober, they learned that they couldn't play with alcohol or drugs, and they never returned. But there was a percentage of these men, about 10%, who would come into the hospital, and they would leave, and they would come back in worse shape that day, that week, that month, or certainly within a very few months, they would be back in the hospital in worse shape than he had ever seen them. And he started to formulate his opinion about these men. And let's go to, if we can, in our big books, I hope you brought them. When they asked me, what should people bring? I said, an open mind and a big book, and water, and a bench, or a bar stool, and a thing. That's what I said. Let's go to page XXV, the doctor's opinion. Now, when the big book was originally written, and I have a first edition, first printing big book, and there's facsimiles of them, if you want to get a first edition, first printing, they are expensive. They're about $20,000 to $35,000, depending on the condition of it. They are expensive, but they're worth having if you can do it. There's something about holding that in your hand that if only the damn book could talk, you know? If only the damn book could talk. Who owned it? Who used it? Who didn't? And mine is in pristine condition. Mine is good with three pluses. So I'm very, very happy to own that. And that will go to someone. That won't go to my daughter when I die. That'll go to someone that's in program. That won't, my daughter would mean nothing to her. So I won't leave that to her. But that's a very special thing. But anyway, this was on page one. This was chapter one. And then when they came out with the second edition, this was moved to the Roman numeral section because the book is supposed to be about alcoholics by alcoholics, and Dr. Silkworth was not an alcoholic, so this was moved to the Roman numeral section. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. Now, before we read another word, I want to remind you of something. This is very important. And I'm going to be talking about this today. I won't be talking about it. I almost said tomorrow. I will be talking about this as the day progresses. But when you walk into a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, you are walking in here on the shoulders of giants. Don't take what you have here for granted. Don't take what you have here for granted. Dr. Silkworth would not allow them to put his name in the book originally until the 10th printing in 1949. Harry Thiebaud, the noted psychiatrist, published a paper where he believed that alcoholism was an illness, and it was accepted by the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association. And Silkworth says, you can put my name in there now. But for the first 10 printings, his name does not appear in this book. And the reason is, he was sticking his neck out. Because if they, at the American Medical Association or the American Psychiatric Association, had found out who wrote this, he could have lost whatever medical practice he had. Because if they didn't agree with his theory, then he could have been out. He could have been O-U-T. And all he was a doctor. He wasn't going to go out and fix shoes. He wasn't going to go out and drive a bus. He wasn't, you know. He was a doctor, and he risked whatever practice he had. So when you see William D. Silkworth on the next page, MD, know the courage that went into him writing this and allowing them in 1949 to put his name in there. He died in 51, but he will forever remain our great medical benefactor. He is a saint. He's the little doctor who loved drunks. But let's take a look at his theory, and let's take a look at what he writes, and we can unlock some of these secrets as to what this is, because you'll hear people coming in, I ate because of my husband, or I ate because of my wife, or I ate. No. If you're a compulsive overeater, you ate for other reasons, not that. We'll get into that in a minute. To whom it may concern, page XXV, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. Now, who is this patient? It's Bill Wilson. In the course of his third treatment, now we're going to learn when we get into Bill's story today, that Bill is going to be hospitalized 3 times for his alcoholism. He acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. In other words, this is a program where you need to sponsor, you need to carry the message. I did a special edition on Vision last Sunday on sponsorship, got a lot of feedback on it. You got a lot of people in OA today that are working in 11-step program. They're afraid to sponsor. Don't be. Lean on step two. Lean on step two. If you use the book to sponsor, then all decision making is taken away from you. The book will sponsor them. If they want to recover, you can't say the wrong thing. If they don't want to recover, then you can't say the right thing. And it has nothing to do with you. It has absolutely nothing to do with you. When you're more invested in their recovery than they are, maybe we need to get our tuchuses right and get to Al-Anon or something. But the bottom line is that you can't hurt them. And if you mention God or you mention recovery, you're afraid, the food will beat them back in. Don't worry about it. Just go out there and work all the steps, not just 11 of them. In the course of his third treatment, possible means of recovery, as part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. And there's that word recovered. If you have worked the steps and you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, you are recovered. If you haven't, then you're not. You can be recovering if you're in the process of working your steps, but it shouldn't be that long of a process. It should be very, very short. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. Now, every method that I tried failed completely, or I wouldn't be sitting here. And when he talks about hopelessness, that means I have to be out of ideas. If you still have an idea in your head about how you're going to go vegan, or you're going to go kosher, or you're going to go gluten-free, or you're going to go vegetarian, or health food, or whatever, and those are fine things. I'm not knocking any of them. They're fine. But if that's what's going to save you, then we probably can't touch you. You have to be out of ideas. You have to be out of plans on how you're going to combat this on your own, by yourself, with unaided willpower. Or my famous one is, I'm going to be abstinent 6 days a week, and one day a week I'm going to eat everything I want to. That, let me just tell you from the other side, that plan is an utter failure. I personally know, okay, these facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch relic in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. And Dr. Silkworth died in 1951. But we can prove in a laboratory everything that he is about to tell us. We can know in our hearts that what he is saying is 100% true. And he will be the first one to examine a side of the illness that we're ready to talk about now on page XXVI or 26 in Roman numerals. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Now, there are a lot of people running around in OA, and you don't have to do this, and you don't have to do that, and there's a million ways to recover. God bless them. I have a book that says there is a solution. Maybe they have a book that says there's 82,000 solutions. I couldn't tell you. But there are some musts in this book, and when it says must, I better pay attention because my life depends upon it. So when he says that I must believe, and it goes on to say that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind, and this is going to be the first foray into a physical component that the world has ever been exposed to. Up to this point, the entire illness of alcoholism, the entire illness of addiction, has been described as weak character, lack of willpower, laziness, stupidity, all the things that I have heard my entire life. Push yourself away from the table. Don't eat so much. You'll feel better. Wow, they were right. When I don't eat so much, I feel anger better, I feel fear better, I feel like killing myself better, I feel crushes on girls better, I feel like jumping out the window better, I feel lots of things better. Wowee. Now, it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. Make sure this next sentence is highlighted in your brain, your eyelids, your book, and your soul. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. And that means that I am going to have to separate from the foods that are triggering the physical allergy. We're going to get into that word in a minute. The doctor's theory, page XXVI, that is 26 Roman numerals, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. We'll come back to that word allergy. As laymen, our opinion to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. What is he talking about there? I would go into a package of Oreo cookies with every intention of just eating one or two, three at the most, and I would not only eat the entire package of Oreo cookies, but I would down a gallon of ice cream and some McDonald's fries and hamburgers and God knows what, pizza, whatever wasn't nailed down, I would finish that too. That once I started, there was no stopping me. That I wanted the 99th Oreo cookie more than I wanted the first one. That all of a sudden something would come over me and I would be unable at all to stop. Though we work out our solution on a spiritual as well as altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. What is he telling you there? He's telling you there, you must, or I must, put down the food. He's telling you there, I must put down the food. He's telling you there, I must put down the food. He's telling me there, I must put down the food. Thank you. And there is no way around that. If I am continuing to eat allergy-producing foods, if I am continuing to ingest foods that for me
sugar or different things. I can have certain things, maybe you can't, maybe you can do certain things, maybe I can't, I don't know. I'm not the world-renowned authority on nutrition and what you can eat or what I should eat. But the bottom line is, if I am continuing to ingest these foods, there is no chance of recovery because I'm going to continue to fire up that allergy. And once that allergy is fired up, I will be absolutely unable to stop. And so he is going to warn me of this 3 times. This is the first of 3 times when he is going to implore me that I must separate from these foods. And I need help with that. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous, where we just don't consume liquor. This is not Narcotics Anonymous, where we cease consumption of narcotics. I need help from a nutritionist. I can't eat things like green grapes, red grapes. I can't eat bananas. I can't eat raisins. Why? They fire up the allergy. Once I eat a red grape, I'm going to eat the vineyard. Once I eat a green grape, I'm going to eat the vineyard. I don't eat dried fruits. Now, you might be thinking, if you're at very early stages of recovery, what the hell's wrong with a banana? If I eat a banana, I'll eat the farm. I just can't consume these foods safely. So I don't consume those foods, but I need the help of someone to help me, and it's not a sponsor. It's a nutritionist for me. For me, I need a nutritionist to help me with what I can eat and what I can't eat. And here's the bad news, or the worst news. As I age, my portions get smaller. I'm 62 now. I don't have the need for the amount of foods that I had when I was 40 or 50 or 20 or 30 or whatever, what have you. So as I age, what happens is my food plan has to change with me. And that's not like AA, and that's not like some of the other programs, because it is not just that I'm consuming no liquor, I have to consume less food too. And that's the bit, you know, I don't want to hear that. Every time I go see this witch, she always takes food away from me. I tell her the same thing every time. I say, I hope you die in a burning building and they can't get you out. And she laughs. She knows I love her. She knows I'm kidding. But a couple of years ago, she took bananas away from me. I says, what the hell? She says, you can eat blueberries. You can eat raspberries with your oatmeal in the morning. You don't need bananas. I'm thought, what the? And I stopped eating the bananas. And God, I noticed, wow, I feel a lot better. I'm not knocking bananas. Can you eat bananas? Absolutely. I'll go to war so that you can eat them. I can't. I'm not telling you don't eat bananas. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about this young man right here from Chicago that's from Chicago, Illinois. I'm talking about me. Okay, is that real clear? I'm not telling you that bananas are Hershey bars. I'm not saying anything. I also don't eat raisins. Why? They do something where it's a party in my mouth. And these things, and there are other issues that come out when you start delving into things. You start hitting layers of that onion, not just in food, but in life. And we can talk about that later if we have time. But the bottom line is, this word allergy baffled me for a long time, because people would say to me, don't eat pizza. Now, I'm from Chicago. You're going to tell a Chicagoan not to eat pizza. So they say, don't eat pizza, you're allergic to it. And I'd say, you're goofy, you're nuts. I'm not allergic. I don't have watery eyes or itchy skin or sneezing or anything like that when I eat pizza. You're nuts. And they'd say, don't eat pizza, you're allergic to it. I thought to myself, now this is the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life. How could I be allergic to these things and not be having itchy, watery eyes and itchy skin or what have you? And I looked up this word allergy in something that is very, very archaic. I bet not most of you even know what it is. It's called a dictionary. It's called a dictionary, and I looked up this word allergy in this old thing called a dictionary, and this dictionary had allergy, and there were several different definitions of this word allergy in it, and one of these definitions fit me exactly when it said an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or substance. Adverse means it's harmful. Abnormal means most people do not react that way. And when I eat candy bars, my reaction is both adverse because it's harmful to me and abnormal because all my friends can take a Mounds bar, where there's two pieces to the Mounds bar, they can eat one piece of the Mounds bar and say, who wants the other piece? And my hand is right there. But they can eat a half a piece of pie and say, who wants to split this? Or they can eat whatever. And I just, you know, I'm not an angry person, but I want to test power tools on their skull. Because they're having this freaking conversation, and there's French fries on the plate! And they're talking to each other and laughing, and there's French fries that they're not eating! And I can't figure it out how do you even do that? And the food isn't doing for them what it does for me. It doesn't give them the effect. We're not going to get to that for a couple of pages. But it's not doing for them what it does for me. And it also doesn't tripwire that physical allergy in them that it does to me. When they eat food, no matter what it is, they get all the food they want every time they sit down to a meal. When they eat a meal, they're done and they're satisfied and everything is fine. They don't desire more food. In my body, not my mind, in my body, the more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, the more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, the more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, and it's just endless. There's no end to it. There's absolutely no end to it. And I have very, very vivid memories of my life, very vivid memories of coming home when I was living alone as an adult, and I would have just binged my freaking brains out. I mean, tonight we ride. Everything goes, you know. One restaurant to the other, to the convenience store, to this, to that, to this, to that. And I'd be coming home, and in a series of split-second decisions, every one of which must be right, I'm in the bathroom, and it's shooting out of me from both ends. And if I don't make the right decision, oy vey is mir, do I have a cleanup job? But I'm in the bathroom, and I'm crying tears. And I'm looking in the mirror, and I'm wishing God would strike me dead because I can't live like this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. The pain is just too great, and I can't bear the pain of not eating, and I can't bear the pain of eating, and I just want out, and I don't have the onions to shoot myself. I'm not a violent person. I don't own guns. I don't have the guts to take a shard of glass and cut my throat. I just want God to strike me down dead. And I would wash my hands, and I would look in the mirror as I'm washing my hands, and I'd be cursing myself, and I'd be wishing that I was dead. And what would I do after having one of these episodes? Where would I go to seek relief from the pain of doing what I just did to myself? Where would I go? Right to the refrigerator to see if there was something in that refrigerator that I could eat to take away the pain of eating too much food. Now, if that's not plain insanity, I do not know what is. I'm standing in the basking light of this bulb that's coming out of my refrigerator. I'm basking in its glow. I should have put a tanning light in there. I'm basking in its glow, wondering what I can eat to take away the pain of the eating that is killing me and ruining my life and squashing my dreams and killing my life one day, one decade at a time. My life is going down the toilet, and it's time I will never get back. Who does that to anybody, let alone themselves? And that's exactly what I did. Not once, not 100 times, but 1,000 times, 10 times, 1,000 times, 1,000 times. I did it, and I did it. I wouldn't do it to you, they'd put me in jail. If I did to you what I did to me, I'd be in prison. I'd be in prison. But I was doing it to myself because of this illness being greater than anything I can control on my own unaided willpower. Let's go to
wait, so we work out our solution, okay. Yeah, the doctor writes, XXVII, 27 in Roman numerals. The doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical directors of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, Towns Hospital, treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. This next paragraph is very important. Not that there's unimportant paragraphs, but this is extremely important. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. What is he telling you in this paragraph? He is telling you that we are doctors and we know what's wrong with you and there's nothing we can do to help you. There's nothing they can do to help you. They can operate on you, they can give you bariatric surgery, and you, if you're a compulsive overeater, you'll end up right back in the rooms. They can give you amphetamines, and if you are a compulsive overeater, you'll either overdo the amphetamines or whatever, but you'll end up back in the rooms. There's nothing medical science can do for the compulsive overeater or the alcoholic. It must come from a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors of this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive in their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power, notice it's capitalized, he's talking about God, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Now, this paragraph refers to Bill Wilson, and when Bill Wilson, we're going to read that when we do Bill's story, he's going to get sober in December of 1934, and he wanted to work with other alcoholics at the Towns Hospital. Now, they didn't know what we know today, and that is Bill Wilson is going to be the 20th century's greatest social architect. They didn't know that this was the answer. So they were very reluctant to let him do so. He's not a doctor. He's not a professional counselor. He's not a, what are they doing today? They're becoming addictions counselors. If I had a dime for every person that says to me, I'm going to get an addictions counselor. Are you addicted? No. But I really want to help other people. Well, unfortunately, in order for the message to be carried, it must have depth and weight, which we'll talk about in a second here. Later, he requested the... Now, bottom of the page. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum importance. What's he telling you there? Put down the food. Put down the food. Put down the food. Put down the food. Very good. Very good. If you're still eating allergy-producing foods, you will not recover. There will be nothing going on there. They don't say to men or women in Alcoholics Anonymous, keep drinking and let's work the steps and eventually you'll stop. They don't say that. They say, plug the jug, don't they? They say, plug the jug. And then when you've plugged the jug for a couple of days, now we can begin working the steps. I heard one woman call me last week. She says, my sponsor told me I had to be abstinent for 30 days before I could work the steps. I says, oh my God, if I could be abstinent for 30 days with no steps, I wouldn't be in Overeaters Anonymous. A couple of days is fine. It says in the big book, 2 days. They put Bill Dotson in a private room, and what does it say? 2 days later, we came to see him. 2 days, not a month later or 2 months later. 2 days. You have 2 days abstinent. Now we can begin to do some business here. Okay, let's take a look at this very important page. We're at the top of 28 in Roman numerals, XXVII. We believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Having lost their self-confidence, how was I supposed to maintain any type of self-confidence when I lied to myself every day? I would tell myself every day, and I meant it, Monday I'm going to stop doing this. Monday I'm going to go on a diet. First of the year I'm going to go on a diet. After the Super Bowl I'm going on a diet. After Passover I'm going on a diet. After my birthday I'm going on a diet. After this I'm going on a diet. After that I'm going on a diet. And the bottom line is that I was telling myself the truth and then realized I was lying to myself. How was I supposed to have confidence in myself? Now I have credibility with me, because when I say something to me, I'm going to do it. Because of God and these steps, their problems pile up on them. Of course my problems piled up on me. Every ounce of brain power that I could muster was being given to either actively eating or actively not eating. Actively eating or actively not eating was my entire life. I had no brain power for homework. I had no brain power for tasks. I had no brain power for life. Everything about my life was either actively eating or actively not eating. And so, of course, my problems piled up on me and became astonishingly difficult to solve. Frothy emotional appeal, continuing on the page. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Meaning frothy emotional appeal means bribing you, browbeating you, begging you to go on a diet. How effective has that been through our lives? Not too effective. As soon as those people went to sleep, we ate. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Let's stop right there. What did Bill Wilson bring, Bob? Information?
No.
He gave him a message of allergy and the twist of the mind, which we'll get into in a second. And Bill and Bob, being a physician, didn't really know that. What did Bill bring Bob? He brought him identification, one to the other. He brought him something that is very, very special. Bill Wilson spoke in Akron, Ohio on that May Day in 1935. He spoke and he understood the language of the heart. He understood, they understood each other because they were two alcoholics. We are the only people who speak and understand the language of the heart. We are the only people who speak it because we've lived it. And we are the only people who understand it if we have recovered, because we are the only group of people on planet Earth that have enjoyed a recovery therefrom. You could be the top psychiatrist, psychologist, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, whatever have you, it won't matter unless you've actually been there, unless you've actually lived in this recovery, you just don't know. Now I'm going to say something else too, and you are free to ignore it. I'm going to give you my opinion. In Overeaters Anonymous, we are hugging each other to death. We are hugging each other to death. We are seeing people and we are hugging them to death. What does that mean? We are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars from World Service to attract brand new people in the rooms. And we should do that. That's good work. And we are sending people to fairs and carnivals and all kinds of places. Our PIPO committees are fantastic. They're wonderful. We are trying to attract people into these rooms, and we should do that. That's good work. But there are people sitting in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous right next to us that are dying of their untreated addiction, and we are hugging them to death. I'm not saying we have to be brutal. I'm not saying we have to be, you know, without compassion.
but we are hugging each other to death. And the only people in the world that can carry this message is someone who has lived it. God's got a job for me, and he's got a job for you, is to carry this message. It's very, very important that we understand that the message has to have depth, and the message has... We'll take questions around 11:30. Write it down. Is it that urgent?
I don't understand what you mean by hugging each other to death.
We are telling people that are dying of their untreated illness, keep coming back, you're wonderful, you're great, I just ate 3 cakes. Hey, way to go, hey, way to go. You didn't eat 4, that's great, you only ate 3. We've got to gently, with love, say to people, you are getting significantly larger. I'm seeing it. What can I do to help you? I love you. What can I do to help you? And they're sitting in the rooms. They're already here. They're already here. And that's what I mean by we're hugging each other to death. That's what I'm talking about. I was one of those people. I was getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. And this goes on too much. I'm not saying we have to be without love. You know, love without compassion is love without compassion is sentimentality. Compassion without love is brutality. No, compassion without love is sentimentality. The other, one is brutality. There's middle ground between brutality and sentimentality. We can gently, in a friendly way, say, what can I do to help you? Instead of just hugging them and telling them to keep coming back and all this stuff. We need to look at that. And in order for the message to be carried, it really must have depth and weight. Okay. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. In other words, they must have reached a bottom. They must have reached a bottom. The pain of eating must be greater than their fear of giving up the food. The pain of eating must be greater than the fear of letting the food go. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children, let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work, and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Now, this next paragraph is a paragraph that if I sponsor you, I will be referring to for the rest of your life. We will be talking about this program for probably the rest of your life. This is one of the quintessential paragraphs in the book, and we're going to expand on it. It says here, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And what is impunity? It comes from the same root word as punished. My friends can eat Oreo cookies and they don't have to pay a price. They don't gain weight. They don't crap in their pants. They don't pee in their pants. They don't ruin their lives because they ate Oreo cookies. They don't get punished for it. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Now, if you haven't paid attention to anything I've said so far, or if in your mind you have thought everything I've said so far is a bunch of hogwash, I would suggest strongly listening to this next thing. Because this next thing has saved my life many, many times, and I'm going to share it with you. If you are a compulsive overeater, food is never the problem. Food
is the solution to the problem. We grow up thinking food and weight are the problems. They are not. They are the solution to the problem. If food is the solution to the problem, what is the problem? The problem is the buildup of everyday, normal, human emotions. All human beings have happiness. Yeah, happiness. You eat when you're happy. Sadness, jealousy, anger, fear, regret, resentment. All human beings have these emotions. Now, if food was the problem, treatment centers would turn out winners, and they don't. If food was the problem, bariatric surgery would turn out winners, and most of the time they don't. If food was the problem, hospitals would turn out winners, and they don't. If food was the problem, diets would work, and they don't for us. They work for other people, not for us. Because you see the normal people, when they have these emotions, they can do simple things to dissipate the level of these emotions quite readily. They can, when they're unhappy, when they're upset, when they're very happy, they can go to the gym and everything's groovy. They can walk the dog, everything's great. They can play with the cat, they can listen to music, they can make love, they can drink a glass of wine, and everything is fine, and it's done. It's over. But in our minds, in our souls, these emotions pinball around, and then they get the attention of the mental twist, which is right here on the emotional side of the brain. And the mental twist says, eat a Mounds bar. And the intelligent side of the brain over here says, don't you dare. Oh, don't you eat no Mounds bar, buddy. Your Mounds bar days are over. You've had enough Mounds bars. And the mental twist says, don't listen to him. Eat a Mounds bar. Now, in the back of the emotional side of the brain is the mental blank spot, the built-in forgetter. I can't remember what the food does to me. I can only laser in on what the food does for me, giving me that sense of ease and comfort that Dr. Silkworth calls the effect. So I eat the Mounds bar in search of a relief to the untenable, unbearable, searing, unrelenting pain of not eating. Because not eating is so painful for me that I cannot stand it anymore. And he says, although we admit it's injurious, I know I'm killing myself. But I can't help doing it because my brain will say tomorrow will be different. And in the compulsive overeater addict mind, anytime there is conflict between the emotional side and the intelligent side, the emotional side will win in a walk, and the intelligent side is silenced because we can no longer stand the pain of not eating. We can't stand it anymore, not because food is the problem, but because food is the solution to the problem, because food does something for me, not to me, for me, that it does not do for the normal temperate eater. Food will give me an instant sense of ease and comfort, no matter how physically distraught I am because of this disease, no matter how financially distraught I am, no matter if I have a crush on a girl that doesn't even know I'm alive, if I'm carrying unrequited love in my heart, if my finances are deplorable, then a Mounds bar or an Oreo cookie for about 9 seconds will make the world go away. And everything is groovy. Oh, it's orgasmic, isn't it, for about 9 seconds? And then what happens? Uh-oh. What did I do? Well, I might as well eat them all now because tomorrow when I go on my diet, I don't want these in the house. Now I have sprung the physical allergy. And the physical allergy makes it impossible for me to stop once I've started. Now, if I can't eat because of the allergy and I can't keep from eating because of the twist of the mind, I am powerless over food, my life is unmanageable. So it begs the question, what if I could find a way to live where my mind does not lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating an Oreo cookie? What if I could find a way to live where I already feel better? What if I could find a way to live where these emotions do not build to the level where they become very dangerous for me? And the process of bringing the necessary power into the equation is simply called recovery. And that's what this is all about, Charlie Brown. This is about substituting the effect of the food for the effect of the spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And the steps will give me a lifetime of happiness rather than just a moment of temporary pleasure with none of the devastating side effects. No God, no doctor has ever said to me, I think you should sponsor less people. I don't like how many people you're sponsoring. No doctor has ever said to me, I think you should do less 10-step calls. You're doing too many 10-step calls. No doctor has ever said to me, cut back on the meetings. I don't like what I'm seeing here. But they have yelled and screamed and jumped up and down and gotten in my face and screamed at my mother and screamed at my father and done all these gesticulations because they are saying, these Mounds bars are killing you. Why didn't I eat a Mounds bar today? Why didn't I overeat today? Because I don't want to. I simply don't want to. Because of a God that is in my heart and in my soul that is there because of the working of the steps, all of them. I simply do not overeat because I don't want to. When I'm looking at the world and I'm feeling my feelings, there's two doors. Eat the food, work the steps. I've worked my fingers to the bone, tunneling through dirt and rocks and clay, looking for a third door. There's no third door. I've already done the work for you. There's no third door. It's either eat the food or work the steps. And if I'm working the tools or I'm just using the meetings as a way of dieting with group support, I will not recover. Maybe you will. I won't. Now, the depth at which you absorb the information I just gave you will mark the urgency that you will attack the rest of the 11 steps. And until you absorb what Dr. Silkworth is telling you, you'll be very blasé about all of it, and you will continue to fail if you're me. You will continue to struggle because without a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, no recovery can take place. There is no middle ground here. If you get spit on, you send the money. There's no middle ground. Everything I do today, I'm either walking toward the food or I'm walking toward recovery, and there is no middle ground. It's black or it's white. People, I hate that black and white thinking. I don't know what to tell you. It's either black or it's either the food or the spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Those are the two choices I have today. So are we clear that food is never the problem? Are we clear that the only solution is the working of the steps so as to effect a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps, so as to transform my attitudes, my behaviors, and my ideas?